Welcome to the Scottish Housing News Podcast with me, Kieran Finlay, and my co-host, Jimmy Black. The current framework for regulating social landlords in Scotland was introduced in 2019. Since that time, tragic incidents here in the UK and worldwide events have combined to change how RSLs are expected to operate, possibly forever. So today we're asking whether the way RSLs are regulated should also be changed.
Ahead of unveiling a proposed new regulatory framework later this year, the Scottish Housing Regulator has embarked on a national discussion, which is currently inviting views from tenants and landlords on the future of social housing regulation. And that's in the context of MSP's recent concern at the sometimes robust style of regulation. And the MSP has in fact intervened to ask Scottish Housing Regulator for a response to that. So,
with that, we felt it was a good time to talk to the Scottish Housing Regulator's Director of Regulation, Helen Shaw, and its Chief Executive, Michael Cameron. Helen, explain the current process. So you guys have launched a discussion paper. Explain the process, the consultation process, and then how this will tie into a future new regulatory framework.
So we're very much committed to reviewing the regulatory framework every 5 years. And as you've highlighted, the current framework was introduced back in 2019. And to start that process, we've published the discussion paper at the start of June, setting out very much our initial suggestions and what we think we might need to or want to change. And we're keen to hear views from all our stakeholders on those early ideas. We're having a range of engagements with various stakeholders over the summer months up until the middle of August, and we're inviting people to give us written responses. What we will then do is consider all of the feedback that we get and use that to bring forward a revised regulatory framework and associated guidance that will underpin that framework, which we'll then consult on formally during the autumn. We're looking to publish the revised framework in February next year, with a view to that going live on the 1st of April 2024. And the process that we're following is very similar to the two-stage process that we followed for the last review of the regulatory framework. The feedback we got from that was that worked well, so we're taking that approach again. In terms of the discussion paper, what we've set out is our belief that the current framework, which we introduced back in 2019, has worked well during the last 5 years, and it still remains broadly relevant and appropriate. And that's certainly the early feedback that we've been getting from stakeholders, that's the case. But I think we also recognise that it's important that we use the learning that we've had from the last 5 years to ensure that the framework remains up to date. And of course, in doing the review, we've got to recognise the context for social landlords. That, you know, the context is very different now than it was back in 2019. And you know, over the last 5 years, we've seen a global pandemic. The UK's left the European Union. We've had a war in Europe, and there's been significant political change in the UK. And it's also the reality today that tenants and social landlords face enormous challenges. You know, we know that many tenants are facing genuine financial hardship, and we've seen acute issues around homelessness and a temporary accommodation in particular. We're seeing social landlords face with cost inflation that's running well above the headline rate of inflation, higher interest rates, and increasing requirements and quality of homes. And responding to landlords also need to try and keep a focus on keeping rents as low as possible. So all of that is you know, very, very challenging context for landlords to be operating in. But it's important context as well for us about how we set out the regulatory framework for the next 5 years. And part of that will be listening to what's becoming clear, that many involved in social housing have a real appetite for a period of stability and continuity. I think that's a real sense that we're getting.
Helen, could I pick you up on that point? The Scottish Tenants Organisation, which is maybe an organisation that not everybody in the housing world finds acceptable, but nonetheless, they sometimes hit some good points. And what they've suggested in their response to your consultation paper is that a period of stability and calm just simply means light touch regulation and letting the landlords get on with it the way they want to. Are you concerned by that comment at all?
I mean, obviously, we will consider all of the comments that we get back, and we have published the response that the STO have published. I think, you know, people have different perspectives on what that means. I think we the regulatory framework is a fairly robust regulatory framework. It's got a number of principles that are at the heart of that regulatory framework. But we will consider all of the responses that we get and reflect them as much as we can in the revised framework that we publish later this year.
Could we ask Michael?
I don't know if there's anything else you want to add.
Well, I was going to say to Michael, in the context of parliamentary criticism, hasn't that made life difficult for you, having MSPs basically criticising the way that you're doing your work?
Well, we have very regular engagement with the parliamentary committee that we're accountable to. And of course, as a public body and as a regulator, we are accountable to Parliament. These issues that have been raised directly in Parliament, raised by two MSPs, but they're not issues that have been picked up with us by the parliamentary committee that we are directly accountable to. And what we've been focusing on with that committee and what the committee wants us to focus on are those big challenging issues that are there for both tenants and social landlords. So Helen's touched on a few of those, but issues around cost of living crisis, affordability, the number of people who are currently in temporary accommodation, the real challenges that are there for landlords around cost inflation, supply chain issues, and of course, more recently, we've seen engagement with the parliamentary committee around the issues of damp and mould. So those are the things which we are principally focused on now, and which the parliamentary committee is engaging with us with, and we have regular contact with the parliamentary committee to keep it up to date in all aspects of our work. And I think it's worth emphasising that certainly I believe we are an effective regulator, and we're doing the job that's been set by Parliament for us to do, and that we look to do that as well as we possibly can.
Michael, Helen mentioned there that there has been a feeling and a sense of a period of stability needed going forward here, but in the discussion paper the regulator talks about areas of change, most importantly listening and responding effectively to tenants and service users. Can you talk a bit more about that and other areas of change, of potential change?
Sure, and I think one of the things that we want to do is ensure that the regulatory framework reflects the current reality that both tenants are experiencing and also that social landlords are experiencing. And of course, when we look at some of the developments that there have been, particularly down south around tenant and resident safety issues, and particularly some of the lessons that are coming out of the Grenfell inquiries, where very evidently tenants and residents were not being listened to, we felt it was important to reflect some of those lessons and ensure that they are given the appropriate emphasis in our regulatory framework. Now, that's not to say that we are doing so because we are seeing that there's problems in Scotland around tenants being listened to. We think many Scottish landlords have very well developed approaches to engaging with their tenants and listening to tenants. And of course, many tenants are on committees and boards of RSLs in Scotland. But it's right, I think, that we ensure that there is an appropriate emphasis in these matters in the regulatory framework. So it's about just strengthening where it's right to do so and ensure that those messages around tenant resident safety, listening to tenants, ensuring that tenants have the right ways to be able to bring concerns to their landlords, and with an understanding that the landlord will respond to those concerns.
You have a national tenants panel. What's the function of that?
That panel, and it's roughly around about 500 people from across Scotland, and the purpose of that panel is really just to give us a sense of the priorities of tenants, the issues that might be concerning them, and areas that they think it's appropriate for us to be focusing on as a regulator. So we use that alongside other ways in which we engage with tenants. We have our standing liaison group with the regional networks in place that allow us to engage regularly with representatives of tenants from those groups. We also have our tenant advisors who work with us on direct scrutiny of social landlords. So we have a range of different ways in which we can gather in the perspective of tenants. And added into that, we also have two tenants on our board, and they bring a whole range of skills and experience to that role. But they absolutely bring that perspective that tenants can bring of the reality of living in the communities that social landlords serve. So we use all of those approaches to give us as good an understanding as possible of those priorities of tenants, of issues that they would be keen for us to focus in on. And that helps us to calibrate and set what work we need to do over a period of time.
A couple of your respondents have said that they would like a key set of indicators, national indicators, which would enable a proper picture to be drawn of where we are with dampness and mould across the country. They feel that that's not there just now. Are you attracted by the idea of a set of key indicators, Helen or Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose more generally, in terms of the questions that we've asked in the discussion paper, we have asked whether landlords think we should be collecting data around damp and mould, and specifically if we are collecting information around about that, what is the best information that we collect in relation to this. I think we do understand the issues of damp and mould are very complex and can be difficult for organisations to manage. So I think our focus is very much on understanding that how landlords deal with issues of damp and mould that are raised with them and how swiftly those are responded to. We've more broadly done some work with the CIHS, FHA and ALACHO to help promote good practice guidance for the sector on how to deal with damp and mould, and we think that there's some merit in that, but we're certainly keen to hear from the sector about what indicators would be the best indicators for us to consider in relation to managing damp and mould. I think it's clearly a very important issue, and it's important that landlords are able to respond to issues of damp and mould when they arise.
Another issue that caught my eye from the discussion paper was the issue of a potential intermediate regulatory status. So you, at the moment you've got compliant and non-compliant, and Helen, I've heard you talk before about how a third status or a third indicator could help.
Certainly, our starting point in terms of the regulatory status is that for RSLs is that's been an effective addition to our regulatory framework. It delivers greater transparency about our regulatory view of RSLs. Some stakeholders have suggested to us that there might be some value in us using more direct language, and also have suggested the addition of an extra regulatory status sitting in between a compliant status and a non-compliant status. So something along the lines of compliant with improvements needed. And the kind of sense that we're getting from some stakeholders, and some of that has included some feedback from some tenants that we've spoken to, is that would increase the transparency around the current performance of individual landlords. And at the same time, also reducing the potential from a sudden movement from a compliant to a non-compliant status. So we're interested to get some feedback from landlords about whether they think that would be helpful.
Board members that I speak to, and I'm a board member myself, find the level of regulation and the detail difficult to cope with. And I wonder if it's a bit of a disincentive to people who are not already in the housing profession or accountants or lawyers or whoever to get involved in boards, because it really does get very complex. And you have that terrifying thing every year where you have to sign off a statement saying that everything's going well and we're fully compliant with the regulator's requirements. And how can you possibly know? Because ultimately you're depending on your staff to give you honest feedback. And so at that point, you know, that's when board members have to have a whole lot of expertise, so they're able to analyse what they're given and try and work out what's really happening. Somebody who responded to your consultation was saying that we have almost got to the point where we have broken the camel's back, and you know, it'll be difficult to recruit board members because of this. What's your response to that? I mean, is simplification of regulation, is that just not possible because things have gone so far towards the kind of business model that we all seem to follow now?
Well, do you know, I remember a conversation that I had with a group of board and committee members from RSLs in Easterhouse, and this must have been about 8 or 9 years ago. And I remember saying at that time that I imagined few of them, when they joined the board or committee, would have thought that a good chunk of their time would have been consumed talking about how to manage significant deficits in the pension scheme they provided for their staff. And that was a big issue at the time, and it remains an issue for many landlords. And you know, there was a lot of nodding of heads and comments about the complexity of the role, and many of them said that they hadn't appreciated what they would have to deal with when they first joined the board or committee. I met with the same group of RSLs late last year, and you know, we had a very similar conversation, although this time it was about the complexity and challenges in supply chains and lending agreements and meeting net zero ambitions, to name just a few of the issues that were touched on. And it for me, it was a very real reminder of the challenges that come with the role of a board or committee member today. And I think we do need to recognise that over the last few decades, RSLs have grown both in terms of size and the range of services that they offer and activities that they are involved in. And they've become increasingly sophisticated organisations that operate in an increasingly complex world. And that makes the role of those people who are there to direct and govern the RSL considerably more complex and challenging than it once was. Now, having said all of that, one of the important strengths of RSLs is the commitment, enthusiasm, the skills and knowledge and diversity of the people who govern the organisations, almost all of whom, of course, are volunteers. So, you know, it is critical that landlords and all the kind of relevant sector bodies that are there have ways to support board and committee members to bring and gain the skills and knowledge to be effective and provide leadership to achieve the RSL's purpose, delivering good tenant outcomes and to manage the organisation's affairs effectively. And you know, we recognise that tenants and local people can help to ground a landlord in the community it serves. A strong tenant voice is a priority for us. You know, I've already mentioned that we have two tenants on our board, and as I mentioned previously, they bring a range of skill, but it's that direct experience of living in the communities that is invaluable, that perspective. So, you know, I think it's also critical that landlords support tenants and local people to participate as fully as possible, whether that's through being members of the board or committee, or by giving them ways to participate that work for them. And, you know, there are lots of great examples out there of landlords doing just that. And actually, we're looking at the possibility of doing some thematic work around this very topic.
The SFHA commissioned a report by Altair, which outlines some findings and recommendations which they'll then put forward in their response, the SFHA's response to this review. One of the things that they've called for is additional support routes for RSLs to avoid further trouble. I know that it's been suggested in the past that a better governed association could step in at a level short of a full takeover to help an association in trouble and then step away once that trouble has been kind of rectified. Is this an approach that you would like look into, or are there other approaches that could do a similar thing?
Well, actually, we've been talking to the SFHA about the possibility of just such an approach, whether it's identified organisations out there that might be able to lend support to other RSLs, or whether there's some kind of service that's offered by representative bodies that effectively is a kind of sector-led improvement service. And I think that would bring real value, because one of the challenges is that when something becomes a regulatory issue, then it's regulatory responses that happen. So if there was a route where a landlord that's got some difficulties, some challenges, can actually get support, whether it's from peers or from a more organised setting, then that might allow us as the regulator to step back and say, okay, well, you know, carry on and do the improvement activity. Keep us advised of how that's bringing you back to compliance or strengthening your compliance or whatever the particular challenge is. So I think there's absolutely value in exploring this, and this is something that we've been talking to sector bodies about for the last couple of years. The last couple of years have been challenging times, but as we start to move into the next few years, there's an opportunity here, I think, for us to look at how we can develop that type of approach.
There was a recent report by Solus, the chief executives of local authorities, and they highlighted the problems of homelessness, and you've highlighted that too in your consultation document. You've mentioned it already today. What can be done about homelessness, in that councils are saying that RSLs should devote more of their homes to letting to homeless people? Clearly, they don't seem to let as many of their homes to homeless people as councils do. What can the regulator actually do to get housing associations to house more homeless people?
Well, there's a lot of things going on in relation to homelessness at the moment, and I'm sure you and your listeners will have seen the output from the Task and Finish Group on temporary accommodation and the recent response to that from the Scottish Government. And it sets out a range of responses that will, I think, help to respond to the kind of challenge that is there, and some of that is about the role of RSLs. I think it's really important that that's a local response that's agreed between the relevant local authority and the RSL, because I think there's a risk in coming in with a kind of single overarching national response that doesn't reflect the local context. Now, there's actually quite a bit of work going on. I'm involved with a group led by the Scottish Government involving the SFHA, the Forum, ALACHO, that is looking at how to bring forward some practical measures that can respond in particular to the real challenge we face at the moment around the number of people who are in temporary accommodation. So I think that's looking to get those responses moving really quickly, because I think that's what's needed. So hopefully, if you watch this space, there'll be some meaningful measures brought forward. That's the whole sector recognising that this is a critical issue and an issue of some urgency.
More and more recently, there's been more control of how RSLs operate, particularly over the rent levels. That's been brought up by one of your respondents. Certainly, you know, if there was any attempt to impose some kind of national target on the number of lets to homeless people, I think that would meet resistance. Is it sometimes tempting to actually regulate RSLs too much and deny them that independence of movement that makes them special?
I mean, I think it's absolutely the case that we do regulate independent organisations, and we set out as clearly as we possibly can the basis of that regulation. And that's not about us, you know, aiming to straitjacket RSLs in any fashion. It's about setting out clear standards, clear outcomes, and that includes through the Scottish Social Housing Charter, that landlords are to achieve. How they go about achieving that is then a matter for them. But we will focus on our job, which is set by Parliament, which is to monitor, assess and report on the performance of social landlords against the Charter and against those regulatory standards of governance and financial management, and to intervene where a landlord fails. That's the role that's given to us, and that's what we set to do. You know, a landlord that complies with those requirements, you know, we'll see very little of us, other than our normal regulatory returns to allow us to do that function of monitoring, assessing and reporting.
Just on that, given the level of regulation and compliance that now required, and as we've mentioned, it's ever increasing, is good governance still possible in smaller housing associations?
Helen might want to come in with some more specific information on this, but absolutely, I think it is. You see well-governed organisations of all sizes in the bodies that we regulate, and some incredibly effective governance happening in smaller organisations. So I don't see why there isn't. I don't see barriers to that. I agree that there are real challenges given the complexity of everything that's going on at the moment. You know, that anecdote I related to earlier about governing body members having to have sufficient levels of understanding around pension schemes and pension deficits and the management of these kind of issues is just one illustration of how challenging the role now is. But there are many very competent governing body members of RSLs of all different sizes, and so I don't think size is a barrier to effective governance.
I was just going to say, when you actually, I think just to echo Michael's point around about the sector's expertise in governance, I mean, actually, when you look at our regulatory status, the majority of organisations have demonstrated that they are complying with our regulatory standards of governance and financial management, and it's only a very small number of organisations that are not compliant with those standards. I think it's important to have that context, and I think that probably echoes Michael's point about the fact that you know, irrespective of the size of the organisation, that the sector is responding to the significant challenges that they face and the complexities that they face at this point in time.
Maybe one of the last things we want to ask you today is about energy. And there wasn't so much in the consultation about energy efficiency or the way forward, yet it's a huge challenge for housing associations. They're going to have to find ways of avoiding direct emissions heating systems in the future and keeping their rents affordable. You have all of these parameters they'll have to meet. How are they going to do that, and how can you support them to do that?
Well, we're currently awaiting the outcome of the Scottish Government's review of the energy efficiency standard for social housing. We're part of the working group that's looking to bring that forward, and I think there's a real appetite amongst social landlords to get some clarity on what the expectations will be around the energy efficiency standard and how that takes us forward towards that future where we have net zero in the homes that we provide for tenants and residents. I think you're absolutely right when you highlight this as one of the biggest challenges in front of social landlords. I think both in terms of understanding the technologies that are available and that might become available, but probably the biggest thing that I know will be keeping many chief executives of housing associations and their finance officers awake at night will be how to fund the likely requirements that will come out of the energy efficiency standard. And I think this is something that we've repeatedly flagged to the Scottish Government, that there is a real challenge there. Most social landlords' business plans at the moment don't have a provision for what is likely to come. Some do, but not all do. And even those that do have, you know, it's arguably the case that they won't have that fully costed out in terms of what is likely to come our way. So that is a major issue. And balancing those kind of future costs
and the kind of inflation that we're seeing at the moment. And it's worth emphasising that we're certainly very aware that inflation for social landlords is running well ahead of the kind of headline inflation rate. You know, we're seeing maintenance costs increasing by in the region of 18 to 22% on an annual basis for social landlords. So you factor that in, and these new costs that will come the way, and there is a major challenge for social landlords on accommodating those costs while keeping rents affordable. And I think there will have to be conversations at a national level about how these ambitions are funded.
Of course, these costs that are coming, or many of them, could be coming in the upcoming housing bill. We don't know when this is going to arrive, but I just want to ask, is there discussions between SHR and ministers regarding the timing of this vis-a-vis the new regulatory framework?
Well, as we understand at the moment, the housing bills that are there and anticipated coming forward in this parliamentary term won't directly impact on our legislation that governs how we deliver regulation. So we don't think that ought to have an immediate impact on our regulatory framework review. We're obliged to carry a review out every 5 years anyway, so it's important that we do that now. The bit of the jigsaw, if you like, that isn't there for us at the moment is around the energy efficiency standard and social housing. We will bring forward appropriate ways to monitor landlords to progress towards that standard when the standard is properly defined. So we might need to come back to that at a subsequent point after we conclude this review, depending on the timescale for the conclusion of the Scottish Government's work around the energy efficiency standard.
Are you anticipating that any new housing bills that come along will give you a new job to do in terms of regulating the private rented sector?
Well, there's conversations that we're having with the Scottish Government to understand what its position might be around any future role for us in private rented sector regulation. And I think what we have certainly said is that there are very significant differences between the private rented sector and the social rented sector, and any kind of approach to the regulation of the private rented sector would have to reflect on those very significant differences. And whether that meant there was a future role for us is something that has to be discussed. Very conscious that in terms of the wider public sector reform agenda that the Scottish Government has, that there's an appetite not to create new public bodies and to look to existing public bodies to expand their role and take on new roles if that's appropriate. So we're conscious that's something that we'll have to stay close to the Scottish Government on and understand their thinking about.
Okay, thanks for your time, guys. We do appreciate it. That brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks again to Helen Shaw and Michael Cameron. If anyone is listening to this, would like to take part in the discussion paper consultation, the process comes to an end around about August the 11th, if I'm right. Yeah, Helen's nodding.
Yep. 11th of August.
11th of August. So please put in your responses. Thanks to Jimmy Black, as always. I will be back in a couple of weeks.